Chapter 38. Auraziel, great spirit of the ring, wasn't one to mess about when he had a palace to repair. Down below the tower the work was underway. The buildings around the gardens that had sustained the most damage in the firefight had been encased in teetering bamboo scaffolding, and scores of djinn were already scurrying up and down a maze of ladders, removing rubble, pulling out burned timbers, and expunging any remaining taint of magic. From the direction of the quarry came sounds of frenzied hammering. Afrits flew west toward the forests in search of logs. In the forecourts, lines of moolahs stood beside cement vats, stirring industriously with their tails. Moolah, an incredibly dull subtype of spirit. Imagine a small, slow, beige-coloured... No, it bores me to death just describing them. While in the gardens, stretched away into the blue distance, armies of imps laboured to reseed the blackened lawns. Among it all strode Solomon, leading the Queen of Sheba by the hand. From where I was, up on the balcony, even Solomon and Balkis's monumental self-regard seemed insignificant. They were simply two tiny figures in gold and white, almost indistinguishable from the straggling pack of onlookers following at their heels. The usual assemblage of warriors, official, wives and slaves. It appeared that most categories of palace personnel, other than the magicians, had managed to survive the night with their servility intact. The indignant twittering of the wives as they assessed the Queen of Sheba carried through air like the calls of roosting birds. In many ways, things were back to normal. Balkis moved slowly, stiff-backed, the picture of brittle pride. Solomon with more of a graceful step. Now and then his arms made extravagant flourishes, no doubt as he pointed out the wonders of his gardens. On one hand, there shone a little flash of gold. It had to be said that given the amount of power he had at his command, Solomon was, by human standards, quite admirably restrained. Most of his actions seemed more or less designed for the common good, and he was personally magnanimous too, as Asmira and I had just found out. But all in all, he was still a king at heart, and that meant grand and flashy. Even his casual throwaway magnanimity to us was, in its own way, grander and flashier than all his jewels. Not that you were going to hear me complaining. But as for the Queen of Sheba, well, high on his lofty vantage point, the dark-eyed Sumerian youth made a rueful face. He hauled his ragged essence off the balustrade where he'd been leaning and went inside. It was time for me to go. I found the girl sitting on one of the golden chairs in Solomon's apartments, eating large quantities of honey cake with all the delicacy and restraint of a famished timber wolf. The glamour laid upon the room had been blown apart during the night's fighting, along with several couches, carpets, murals, and Solomon's crystal orb, which now looked blank as rainwater, the spirit trapped inside having been happily released. She didn't stop when I came in, but went on scoffing. I sat in a chair opposite and appraised her properly for the first time since my return. Physically, she had the right number of arms and legs remaining. Otherwise, she was undeniably the worse for wear. Her clothes were torn and scorched, her skin bruised, her lip a little swollen. In places, her hair had been discoloured green by a blast of magic fire. None of this could exactly have been considered a plus, yet it wasn't the whole story by any means. As she took a long slug of Solomon's wine, then wiped her sticky hands deliberately on one of his silken cushions, a perceptive onlooker, me, could also note that she seemed a good deal more vibrant and alive than when first I'd seen her, so stiff and cold upon her camel in the gorge that day before. Badly as Asmira's exterior had been battered by the night's events, I guessed that a chain inside her had also been broken, and this breakage wasn't a bad thing. She took a couple of grapes and an almond bun.
"Still down there, are they?"
"Yes, busily doing the tour." I narrowed my handsome eyes meditatively.
Is it me, or is your good Queen Balkis something of a sour old trout? Asmira gave me a crooked grin. I must say, she wasn't as generous as I'd hoped. That's putting it mildly. Well, what can you expect? The girl flicked pastry off her lap. She sent me out to do a nice clean assassination and steal the ring. Now she finds me praised to the skies by Solomon, the ring still on his finger, and herself summoned to Jerusalem like a dumb imp on a leash. It was a fair analysis. He'll win her over, I pointed out. He always does. Oh, she'll forgive Solomon, Asmira said. She won't forgive me. She went back to her cakes. There was silence for a while. Good job you got the offer, then, I said. She looked up, chewing. What? Solomon's offer. Richly rewarding you for helping him move forward with his new progressive government, or whatever it was. All sounds a bit woolly to me. Still, I'm sure you'll be happy. I stared up at the ceiling. You seem disapproving, the girl said. I scowled. Well, it's just him using his charm on you, isn't it? Hooking you with that sparkly one-on-one eye contact stuff, all those white-toothed smiles, that business about trusting you with his life. That's all very fine, but where will it end? First you're a guard, then a special advisor. Next thing you know, you'll be in his harem. All I can say is, if that happens, make damn sure you don't sleep in the bunk below the wife from Moab.
I'm not going in his harem, Bartimaeus.
Well, you say that now, but
I'm not taking up his offer.
She took another swig of wine. What? Now it was my turn to look bemused.
You're turning him down?
Yes.
But he's Solomon. And leaving aside what I just said, he is grateful.
I know that, Asmira said, but I'm not entering his service, even so.
I'm not going to simply swap one master for another.
I frowned. That chain inside her had snapped, all right.
Are you sure about this? I said.
Yes, he's a conceited autocrat. Yes, he's got a mania for collecting wives. But he'll still make a better boss than Balkis by a long shot. For a start, you wouldn't be a you wouldn't be an hereditary guard. There'd be a lot more freedom for you, and gold, too, if that tickles your fancy.
It doesn't. I don't want to stay in Jerusalem.
Why not? Thanks to that ring, it's the center of the world.
But it isn't Sheba. It isn't my home.
And suddenly, in her eyes, there was that same fire that I'd noticed the night before, burning brightly still, but with a gentler flame. All its anger, all its zealotry had gone. She smiled at me.
I wasn't lying to you, what I said last night. Being a guard, doing what I did. Yes, I was serving the queen, but I was serving Sheba, too. I love its hills and forests. I love the desert, glittering beyond the fields. My mother showed it all to me, Bartimaeus, when I was very small, and the thought of never going back to it, or to her.
She broke off.
You can't know what that feeling's like.
Actually, I said, I can. Speaking of which...
Yes, of course.
Asmira stood up, decisively.
It's time. I see that. I have to let you go.
Which just goes to prove yet again that she wasn't really a magician. Since the days of Uruk, all bouts of slavery have traditionally ended with a sordid argument in which my master refuses to set me free, and I become a cackling corpse or blood-clawed lamia in order to persuade him. But the girl, who had freed herself, was happy enough to do the same to me, and do it without a scrap. For a moment I was so surprised I said nothing. I got slowly to my feet. The girl was looking around the hall.
We're going to need a pentacle, she said.
Yes, or even two. There'll be a couple somewhere. We hunted about, and soon enough spied the edge of a summoning circle peeping out beneath one of the singed carpets. I began to throw aside the furniture that covered it, while the girl stood watching me with that same calm self-possession I'd noticed in the gorge. A question occurred to me. Asmira, I said, kicking an upturned table across the room, if you head back to Sheba, what are you going to do there? And what about the Queen? She's not going to be pleased to see you hanging about, if today's spite is anything to go by. To my surprise, the girl had her answer ready. I won't be hanging about in Mareeb, she said. I'll take work with the frankincense traders, help guard them on their journeys across Arabia. From what I've seen, there are plenty of dangers out there in the deserts. Bandits and jinn, I mean. I think I can deal with those. I tossed an antique couch approvingly over my shoulder. That actually wasn't a bad idea. It'll also give me a chance to travel, she went on. Who knows, I might even go to Himyar one day, see that rock city you mentioned. Anyway, the incense trail will keep me well away from Mareeb most of the time, and if the Queen does take exception to me, her expression hardened, then I'll have to deal with it. And her. I wasn't a soothsayer or an augur, and had no knowledge of the future, but I wondered if things might prove a little ominous for Queen Bulkis. But there were other issues to attend to now. I shoved the last bits of furniture to the side, rolled up the priceless carpet, and threw it in the plunge pool, and stood back in satisfaction. There, embedded in the floor and quite undamaged, lay two pentacles of pinkish marble. Slightly fey, I commented, but they'll have to do.
Right then, the girl said. Get in.
We stood facing each other for a final time. Tell me, I said, you do know the words of a dismissal, don't you? I'd hate to hang around for months while you were apprenticed out to learn them.
Of course I know them, the girl said.
She took a deep breath.
Bartimaeus,
hold on a minute. I just spotted something. It was a mural I hadn't seen before, just along the wall from Gilgamesh, Ramesses, and all the other top despots of the past. A handsome, full-length portrait of Solomon himself in all his glory. Somehow, miraculously, it had survived the carnage of the night before. Picking up a bit of burned wood from the floor, I hopped across and made a few brisk adjustments in charcoal. There, I said. Physiologically improbable, but somehow appropriate, don't you think? How long before he notices that, I wonder? The girl laughed. It was the first time in our association that she'd done so. I glanced at her sidelong. Shall I add Bulkis as well? There's a little space.
Go on, then.
There we are. I strolled back to the circle. The girl was eyeing me in that same way Fakwal had, with a sort of detached amusement. I stared at her. What?
It's funny, she said. You make such a big deal out of the horrors of your enslavement that I almost missed the obvious. You enjoy it, too.
I settled myself in my pentacle, fixing her with an expression of bleak disdain. A friendly bit of advice, I said. Unless you're extremely competent, it's never a good idea to insult a departing jinni, particularly this one. In old Babylonia, the priests of Ishtar forbade any magician below the 9th level to deal with me for just that reason. This was after a series of fatalities, my favourite of which was that of a brutish acolyte who tormented me with the inverted skin. However, he also suffered badly from hay fever. I thereupon brought him a massive bunch of pollen-rich lupins, at which he sneezed himself out of his circle.
"Which proves my point," the girl said. "You're always boasting about your past achievements. Come on, admit it. You revel in it all. Even last night I noticed how you stopped your moaning once we were getting near the ring."
"Yes, well," I clapped my hands together briskly. "I had to, didn't I? There was too much going on. Take it from me, I disliked every moment. Right, enough of this. Say the dismissal and set me free." She nodded and closed her eyes, a young, thin girl thinking through the incantation. I could almost hear the cogs grinding as I watched. Her eyes opened.
"Bartimaeus," she said abruptly, "thank you for what you've done."
I cleared my throat.
"Pleasure, I'm sure. Look, do you truly know the words? I don't want to find myself rematerialized into a festering bog or something."
"Yes, I know the words," she smiled. "Come to Sheba some day. You'll like it." "Not that it's ever up to me."
"Just don't take too long. We haven't all got as much time as you."
Then she gave the dismissal, and sure enough, she did know the words. More or less. There were only three hesitations, two fluffed inflections, and one major stumble, all of which, on this occasion, I was prepared to overlook. She wasn't very big, after all, and there wasn't that much meat on her. Besides, I really wanted to be gone. The girl was of like mind. Even as my bonds broke and I was whirling free across the plains, I could see, from seven varied angles, that she had already left the circle. She was walking off, straight-backed and resolute, through Solomon's ruined chamber, looking for the steps that would lead her from the tower, and so into the waiting day. This is Simon Jones. We hope that you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Ring of Solomon by Jonathan Stroud. This program was directed by Mae Wuthrich and produced by Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2010 by Jonathan Stroud. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.